deceive me, or is it all a dream? The golden veil of Limerick in its coat of verdant green, a rare sight was never seen, nor surely never will. Oh, the golden veil of Limerick you can view from Barnet Hill. When standing on the summit of that ancient place around, you can view each town and city far better than a map. Newcastle West and before me lies Goat Street and Whelan's Mill. You can view them all from curtains long at the top of Barnet Hill. You can view the River Shannon and the hills far off in Clare. Rathkeel Croke and Patrick's Well and lovely sweet Adair. Askeaton Arda, Abbey Fale, Ashford and Charleville. You can view them all from curtains long at the top of Barnet Hill. To the right is Ballingarry, 'tis the chief town of the plain, where oft the Lord of Desmond the stately deer has slain, where heroic men in days of yore they showed their power and skill. Let my burial place be mown again at the foot of Barnet Hill.
De Chicago, agus falsha do radio sirsha erin, tamé maya shavan kashlin, gael mór na chalin, and you're listening to Radio Free Ireland here on KBOO. Good afternoon to all of you and to my good co-host Per Fagering.
Here we are on this wonderful day.
if your microphone is working.
Yeah, I think the on button is working.
Okay.
It's on.
I'm getting you. Mm-hmm. I think you're there. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon.
I was never all there.
okay. Thanks for joining us here at Radio Free Ireland. Started out this afternoon's program with a little bit of Patrick Street. And you're not done yet. We're going to be playing a little bit more of these fellas because we're delighted to say that they're going to be paying a visit to our lovely burb. Tomorrow evening, Patrick Street will be appearing at the Mission Theatre and Pub, at 1624 Northwest Gleason. And that show starts at 8 p.m. And we're real pleased that they're back in town. We're a little bit spoiled here. You know, of course, that one of the principals of the band, Kevin Burke, lives here in town. And we're often graced by the presence of the other members of the band, Jed Foley, Andy Irvine, Jackie Daly, and numerous other people. We're hoping to find out what the exact lineup of the band is this time around, when we're joined by our guest music promoter, Bronya Griffin, who will probably be running in here panting and breathless any minute. So we're looking forward to that. Catch up to what these guys have been up to in the last year. There's also a number of other upcoming shows that I want to tell you about. The Karen Casey Band is coming to town, also at the Mission Theatre, also brought to you by Bronya Griffin and I believe Kerry Novotny. And that's going to be a double bill with Fluke, one night only at the Mission Theatre on the 5th of March, so that's coming up very rapidly as well. Also coming up right soon is the All-Ireland Cultural Society's 65th annual St. Patrick's Day celebration 2006, starting on Friday the 17th of March, of course, at 3 p.m. and going all evening at Rosary Hall, across from Calaroga Terrace and Holy Rosary Church, two blocks north of the Convention Centre, between Martin Luther King Boulevard and 3rd, here in Portland. It is handicapped accessible. It is kid-friendly. They have a fully packed schedule of events, starting at 3 p.m. with Irish Ceilidh dance lessons. Then they're going to have a Ceilidh with Mikey Beglin, Mick Mulcruen, Susan Francis, and the Tier 1 Ceilidh Dancers at 4 p.m. They're going to have pipe and drum bands, lots of step dance exhibitions, a couple more Ceilidhs, face painting, colouring contest for the kids, art displays, knitting displays, harp and Guinness displays, of course, corned beef suppers, naturally enough, a raffle, all kinds of food, a soda bread contest, that sounds pretty cool. Sure, it couldn't be simpler. And this is all happening Friday the 17th of March.
How many raisins you can stuff into it?
Oh, well, you know, that's sacrilege, putting anything at all into soda bread. But, of course, that's a whole nother aspect of the thing. I guess you could get into advanced soda bread making, where you can put in, you know, little citrons and dried fruits and stuff.
Like this is Fogarty's Christmas cake.
Right, absolutely. And you can't forget the marzipan. Okay, if you want more information about the All-Ireland Cultural Society or their 65th annual St. Patrick's Day celebration, I imagine they've got it pretty well tuned by now after 65 tries.
They know how to do it right.
I think they've got it down. And they have a phone number here you can call, 503-287-4812 or 503-691-2078 for more information about the upcoming St. Patrick's Day Bash at the All-Ireland Cultural Society. Also coming up at the end of the month, Susan McEwen is going to be in town, and boy, I hope we can get her here in the station. It's been a while. She's going to be also at the Mission Theatre. Looks like that is the place to go these days. And that's going to be happening on the 30th of March. So lots of stuff coming up, boys and girls. You're going to have to be sure to take your vitamins as we get into the silly season. And, of course, there's a lot more to March than just St. Patrick's Day. And we're going to be exploring some of those things here on Radio Free Ireland, as well as delving a little bit into the history of Patrick's Day and how it's come to be the delightful and rather bizarre holiday that it seems to have morphed into. And I have to say that the United States of America has a lot to do with that. This is not solely an Irish thing, an Irish phenomena by any means anymore. So we'll be looking into that. And while we wait for our guest to appear, let's play a little bit more Patrick Street. This is from their 2002 release, Street Life.
Trace from old Colt Station.
Some lovely tunes from Patrick Street. And once again, they're going to be coming to town tomorrow evening at the Mission Theatre, back by popular demand, of course, starting at 8 p.m. at the Mission Theatre, 1624 Northwest Gleeson Street. Really looking forward to that show. We were hoping that Bronya Griffin was going to be joining us from Live from Ireland Productions, but apparently she got held up. So wherever you are, Bronya, we'll make sure to let people know about this great show you're putting on for them. Also coming up by the same production company, Karen Casey Bond and Fluke are going to be appearing at the Mission Theatre on the 5th of March. And Susan McEwen will be there on the 30th. So be sure to write this stuff down on your calendar and keep track of it. Well, there's a bunch of news to check out this week, and I think we're going to start right here in the United States and work our way further afield. First of all, I have some information that Power actually called my attention to regarding St. Bridget's Church in Manhattan. Now, I know any number of the Irish community out here in Oregon has come through New York City, including yours truly. And this church, regardless of your spiritual beliefs or your religious persuasions, this church has particular appeal for the Irish and also for anyone who has a love of history. And I'm talking, of course, about the church that was built by and for famine immigrants in 1848. And it's distressing to note that St. Bridget's is one step closer to the wrecking ball after a judge last week dismissed an action by campaigners to save it. Justice Barbara Kapnick of the State Supreme Court of New York declined to interfere, saying it would be an impermissible intrusion into Cardinal Edward Egan's ecclesiastical authority to mandate that he reopen the shuttered church, which Egan closed in 2001. Apparently, the church is looking to sell it. It's in an up-and-coming neighborhood that's being gentrified, and they want the cash. They want to cash it out. Now, this church is tremendously historic. The sculpted interior includes the faces of some of the Irish shipwrights who built it, carved into some of the sculptures. And it is most assuredly a beautiful memorial to the waves of famine immigrants who reached America in the mid-19th century. You know, the Great Hunger on Gorta Moor, as we often call what is misnomered as the famine. There was plenty of food in Ireland during the famine. The only thing that went up was the potato, which the poor people lived on. The absentee landlords, who were English, would not allow their peasants to eat the food they were growing. Enough food was shipped out of Ireland, according to ships' manifests that are still available to researchers today, to have fed four times the population of the country.
That was global trade at work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it needs to be said that the same is true of famines today.
That's true. Yeah.
There is no such thing as famine with the amount of money, the amount of food, and the shipping technology at our fingertips. There is no such thing as a famine. When people die of starvation, it is a crime of economic violence. So, you know, it's very important to the history of what the Irish suffered on Gorta Moor that this church not be demolished. And it's particularly distressing and shocking given all of, scandals that have beset the Catholic Church in recent years, to think that Cardinal Egan would be so willing to sell off the historical treasures and legacies of his people. I don't see where, first of all, he has the right to sell that off. He didn't build it. The Irish immigrants that came, that made it to Manhattan, and it must be said that, you know, upwards of 50% of the people who left Ireland never made it to anywhere else. They died and were heaved overboard. So this church was a labor of love of the people who survived and made it here. And You know, the carvings in that church were carved with deep love and grief for the people that they loved and left behind, for the people that they saw die from the hunger, from the country they would never see again. There's so much of the human experience wrapped up in this building. And it's truly a shock and disgrace that the church, with all of its resources, feels that they have to sell off the historical legacy of her people in order to pay their scandals off. I dare say the Vatican Bank could come up with the money somewhere else.
I think they got it squirreled away someplace.
You think?
Unless Cardinal Marcinkus took it to the grave with him the other week. He was the head of the Vatican Bank. He was retired and living in Arizona, and he died in his 80s and everything. But
I'm sure he took a number of secrets to the grave with him, but money is still there.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere.
So, yeah. So, you know, those of you people that are listening that feel a certain strong emotion about such issues, feel free to write to your church representatives or to Cardinal Egan yourself. Apparently, it's all up to him now. Mm-hmm. Distressing little story. Also wanted to tell you some good news from New York. And apparently at least one parade, one St. Patrick's Day parade in the Big Apple, is really going to celebrate the diversity of the Irish heritage and culture. Excuse me. Apparently the Sunnyside Parade... the Sunnyside Queens Parade will be assembling at 43rd Street and Skillman Avenue, for those people who know Queens, on St. Patrick's Day, and they will be inviting everyone to come march with them.
Is it earlier? I think, is there a different date on that?
Let me take a look. This comes from WBAI.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh yes, indeed, it's actually starting on the 5th of March, so it's early, I guess not to get in the way of any of the other parades, but apparently they started doing this in the year 2000, and it is the only one of its kind, the first in 250 years of Irish parades in New York City to be open and welcoming to all who share the spirit of the day. We're talking Protestant, Catholics, Choctaws, gays, lesbians, everyone's invited. So it's good to know that at least in some areas of the world, St. Patrick's Day is being broadened to include all people who consider themselves having some connection to the Irish diaspora and, you know, the great celebration, which is St. Patrick's Day. The great and strange celebration, which is St. Patrick's Day. So a little bit of good news and fair play to the folks that put on the Queen's St. Patrick's Day parade. That's the way to hold a parade.
Mm.
We'll also go further afield now. I believe we have some interesting news from Britain.
Yes, well, you know, there was another bank robbery recently. This was in the town of Tonbridge. And it turns out that the modus operandi was very similar to the bank robbery in Belfast a couple of years ago.
Oh, really? You mean the big bank robbery that they blamed on the IRA, went away without any evidence?
Well,
ever?
This one, they're saying this one is being blamed on organized crime, and apparently by now they have more than three or four people arrested.
Right.
And what the robbers did was they waylaid the bank manager, and in another group kidnapped his wife and child, mm-hmm. and hid them someplace, and then I guess they took their time getting all the money out. I think it was millions of pounds from this robbery. But the interesting thing is that this one is being blamed on organized crime, and it's already being remarked that it's very similar to the bank robbery in Belfast in 2004.
Well, why on earth didn't they blame it on the IRA then?
Well, maybe they just couldn't make it stick, you know.
So maybe this is a group of organized crime criminals that are going around inside Britain pulling these heists.
It could be.
So has there been any kind of Has there been any speculation that perhaps the Northern Bank robbery was done by the same guys?
Well, maybe not the same guys, but that by the same general organized crime rather than political, enemies or whatever. So there have been people arrested, and so far I haven't seen any indication of what they, whether they've confessed or said anything at all about it, but.
Interesting.
Another one to keep our eye on. We're keeping our eye on so many things these days.
Indeed. And you know, it is an interesting case because after the Northern Bank robbery, you and I were both very skeptical about the claims of IRA culpability.
Well, especially after they never produced anything.
Right. And, certainly some people said, okay, fine, and if it wasn't the RA, who was it? Well, now we have a very legitimate possibility of who it might have been.
Mm-hmm. Right. Also, you know, Red Ken, Mayor Ken Livingstone of London, has been, you know, he got into a little dust-up with a reporter from the...
The Standard, I believe it was.
Let's see. You spoke
about this some time ago.
Right.
We did talk about it, and he called the guy. He compared him to a Nazi.
This is the way it happened. There was a kind of a birthday party for some gay activist in London, and this newspaper was covering it, and the reporter was trying to talk to people as they left. As they left the event, and he came up to Livingstone and tried to get something from him, and they got into an argument. Now, the paper is, I believe, it's a sister paper to a sort of a notorious London paper that praised the black shirts back in the 30s. It has this pro-fascist past.
Mm-hmm.
And, so anyway, Livingstone sort of asked a guy about, you know, working for this Nazi paper and or sort of a pro-fascist paper, and the reporter said, "Well, I'm Jewish," as though that was an impossibility that it, you know, and so then Red Ken sort of compared him to. Apparently, according to the media, a concentration camp guard.
Right,
And this is what aroused a lot of people. Well, you know, if you look back in history, back in the 30s when the Nazis were all over Europe, there actually were Jews who collaborated with the Nazis.
They're Irish to collaborate with the Brits.
They removed bodies from the showers. They worked as police in the ghettos and helped round up Jews to go on the trains to the death camp. So this is a very unfortunate thing. So anyway, Livingstone, an elected mayor, was suspended by the Standards Board. We have standards here. The paper's a standard, then the Jewish Evening Standard report. Oh, gee, it's just
a lot of standards.
Standards. Anyway, he was suspended for 4 weeks by this Standards Board for being insensitive, and which Mayor Ken Livingstone never claimed to be anything but. And anyway, but he has appealed it, so he is still in office, and so this will... Red Ken claims he says that he will take this all the way to the law lords if he has to. The mayor said that, you know, he also got a lot of support from more mainstream people saying that it's kind of pretty appalling that an elected official can be suspended from office by three unelected people who are just sort of faceless, mm-hmm. Practically nameless. And anyway, so Livingstone said that he had not broken the law and that he reserved the right to treat journalists with the same robustness as they treated him. This is in the Guardian. As far as I am aware, there's no law against unnecessary insensitivity or even offensiveness to journalists harassing you as you try to go home, he said. And he denied that his comments were influenced by alcohol. He said if he had been drinking, it would have been much stronger. And Livingstone also said,
"You've gotta love Red Ken."
He also said that the paper's editor, Veronica Wadley, has had an irony bypass after publishing a profile of him in which I am described as a snappy, snarling brute, voracious, frightening, ugly, raging, and gripped by paranoia. So, I mean, it's like a lot of insensitivity to go around. So that's the latest. Livingston is appealing his suspension, and it will, in the meantime, he is still in office.
I find it interesting that this woman accused Ken of paranoia when it's apparent that they are out to get him.
I guess so. Of course, you know, he got a lot of praise for all the handling all the uproar when the subway bombings
back
in July, you know. He kind of showed his mettle, as it were.
Yeah, and he's well loved by the people there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's clear that he's going to win on appeal, and, you know, they're just trying to make a row out of this.
Mm-hmm.
I just find it so interesting that Britain seems so eager to rein in everybody's impoliteness, you know, with the ASBO laws.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're really trying to put a lot of strictures on people's freedom of speech. And it seems to me that the assumption's being made that you don't have the right to be offended in Britain anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That you no longer have the right to be offensive.
But then apparently free speech does give Blair the right to lie to the people about the war in Iraq,
which is
having repercussions now. This is a story that was in the Scotsman where... a third of Britain's overstretched armed forces would struggle to be ready for action because of the country's heavy military commitments. This is from what they call a damning parliamentary report. And last night it emerged that the government has spent £1 million on private security firms in Iraq, kind of like our mercenaries, prompting calls for the money to be spent instead on the Army, Air Force, and Navy. Because the thing about that is that these mercenary outfits are paid a lot more than ordinary soldiers are.
Right.
So it's really a waste of money.
It's also a big kick in the morale to the grunts on the ground driving around in unarmored Humvees when they see the mercenaries driving better equipment, having all the body armor they need.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stuff that they need when the U.S. military has to go begging.
And then, of course, when the soldiers, when their enlistments are up, a lot of them, they leave and then they join the mercenaries.
Absolutely.
Hey, what the hell, they're getting better paid. Also, as you know,
it's interesting in all of the talk about the trouble meeting recruitment goals.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard them talk about, who is actually their biggest competitor is these mercenary outfits, Blackwater, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they're going to these guys. Your term's almost up. You can make $100,000. Who's going to re-enlist?
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
You never hear any complaints about that particular aspect of the problem.
But apparently the British Army is stretched just as thin as our Army is,
which has got
the governors of... all around the country to complain about how the National Guard is being taken over and they have to leave their equipment in Iraq even when they come home.
Yep.
And
you put that with the announcement recently that they want to put the military now in charge of natural disasters,
mm-hmm,
instead of the National Guard. That makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I don't know about any of you guys out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that, of course, with reports recently of private companies building detention centers around the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely for nervous-making times.
I think so. Finally, we have the update on Princess Di.
Yes, I actually heard about this in the mainstream news. And
yes.
You broke this story here on Radio Free Ireland a couple of months ago.
Well, we talked about it. Yes, this is from the London Times. And the chauffeur of the car in which she died was apparently working for the French Secret Service. This is according to the British team reinvestigating her death.
Hmm.
And this inquiry, headed by Lord Stevens, a former Metropolitan Police Commissioner.
Yeah, we know Stevens, the Stevens Inquiry. He's
uh-huh.
done quite a bit of work, yeah.
Well,
he's generally considered a fair-minded fellow.
I think he was sort of surprised at some of the events, so some of the things that he has unearthed. But the driver's name was Henri Paul, the chauffeur, mm-hmm, and of course he died in the crash too.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that he was working for the French French Secret Service.
Just gets thicker and thicker.
So it's just
there's more to it than
we will see. And then this comes from a columnist, Bill Zwecker, from the Chicago Sun-Times. He talks about the allegation that Paul was working as a spy. Previously, I guess somewhere along the way they try to say he was working for British intelligence, but now it's French intelligence.
Hmm.
And the latest charge, this is quoting Bill Zwecker in the Chicago Sun-Times, the latest charge comes on the heels of extremely disturbing allegations made by Mohammed Al-Fayed. He's the owner of Harrods department store in London.
Yes, Dodi Fayed's dog.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And who was Princess Diana's boyfriend.
Right.
And Al-Fayed charged, this is in an interview with international interviewer Daphne Barak, who I'm not sure who she is, but anyway, Al-Fayed charged that Britain's Prince Philip was intimately involved in Diana's death, ordering a British secret agent to pose as a paparazzo and cause the accident that killed the couple in that Paris tunnel.
Ergo, the laser beam in the eyes of the driver.
Right,
story.
That's what the allegations are.
Fascinating.
And Al-Fayed is quoted as saying the princess received threatening letters from him, Prince Philip, and
wow.
These are now with Scotland Yard.
Wow.
In these letters, this is all quoting Mohammed Al-Fayed. In these letters, Philip said he would kill her. I have seen these letters. And Al-Fayed also called Prince Philip a, quote, a Nazi bastard, unquote, obsessed with preventing Diana from marrying a Muslim and having a child by him.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the latest on that story. So one more story to keep following.
Indeed. It gets thicker and thicker on that, mm-hmm. on that regard. And, you know, certainly the things that have been said about Prince Philip being a Nazi, there's nothing new about this. There have been charges and accusations of Nazi sympathy within the royal family, mm-hmm. going back generations, indeed coming right up to the pictures of Harry at the dress-up, the fancy dress ball.
Of course, the Duke of Windsor, you know, he and his American wife, they were very charmed by Hitler back in the 30s.
There are a lot of people who strongly feel, myself included, that the reason that he stepped down or was made to abdicate was because of his Nazi sympathy, not because he was married to an American divorcee.
Right.
They just used that as the cover story.
And
he used to actually dress up in full Nazi uniforms he was given as a gift from the Third Reich.
Now, was this
parade around in them.
Was the Duke of Windsor, not Prince Philip.
Okay. Right, and he was well known to parade around in them, and this, of course, drove the British security functions absolutely batty, because they couldn't have that at that point. So, you know, it's well known in these circles that's the reason why he was forced to abdicate.
Well, I'd heard that if the Nazis had succeeded in invading England, that
he would
have been back on the throne.
Right.
Finally, we have a story concerning the bird flu. This is from the London Independent of last Sunday, and they're saying that factory farming and the international poultry trade are largely responsible for the spread of bird flu. It's not these little backyard hen houses. It's the global trade, mm-hmm. and they say their basis on what they say is that the spread of the bird flu corresponds not to wild bird flyways or whatever, but it corresponds to the trade patterns.
How about that?
So this is something to keep in mind. You know, it's a question of time before it really hits this side of the world.
Right.
And
what paper did you find that
this
one?
This was from the Independent of Sunday 26 February.
And you know, back in the day when the mad cow thing swept through Britain, It's interesting to note that it did a real good job of getting rid of a lot of small farmers, and most of the ones left standing were the big agribusiness type, well connected, already wealthy, could withstand this kind of a blow. And I have no doubt that the bird flu is going to do the same thing. They're going to go and wipe out all the small farmers, and the only ones left standing will be the factory farms.
I believe that's already happened in Asia.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some underlying economic violence going on with this that has nothing to do with viruses. You know, I think that they're very much using it as an excuse to reshuffle the trading field, shall we say, and shake loose all the smaller players. Kind of a redistribution of wealth upwards in agriculture and animal husbandry, mm-hmm. if you will. So, distressing news indeed. Now we're going to head her over across the water to the Emerald Isle, and we're going to start with Dublin, where there were riots at the weekend. No surprise there, this was forewarned in all the Republican and Progressive papers. And there was at the weekend in Dublin a Love Ulster rally. A bunch of Orange Orders came down and decided to make their presence known and marched through the streets of Dublin. And, you know, basically, I've tried to explain this before, despite all the highfalutin talk about tradition, basically, this is like a KKK march.
Well, didn't they have some, quote, kick the Pope flute corps or something
there,
like that?
Yeah, there was something like 20 or 30 kick the Pope flute bands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are these little, they're named for different loyalist paramilitaries who are now dead. And basically, they go around with banners that say things that I can't repeat on the air, and march around in people's neighborhoods and, you know, basically say terrible things about Catholics in general and the Pope specifically. Now, I'm no great aficionado of the Catholic Church or the Pope, but I certainly feel that this is intrusive, and it's harassment, and it's hate speech. And, you know, it was made clear to these folks that they were not welcome in these neighborhoods. They insisted on having the march anyway. And Republican Sinn Féin, which is a separate group than Sinn Féin up in Belfast, they're not really a split, because they've been a different group for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years now. But they are a group that doesn't believe in the ceasefire, such as the people up in Belfast have been supporting the Good Friday Agreement. And although they aren't really active in an armed struggle, they continue to insist that they are supporting the concept of armed struggle and don't believe it's time to put down the gun yet. Having said that, they don't have an armed military wing, and basically they're just a bunch of blowhards that go around causing trouble for Sinn Féin in Dublin. They got out there, and a lot of people, they didn't have to do a lot of convincing to get people out there to protest this Love Ulster rally. And honestly, I don't understand what the unionists thought they were trying to accomplish by doing this.
What actually happened? Maybe that's what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, if that's what they were trying to accomplish, they went off without a hitch. Mm-hmm. There were a bunch of scuffles. The police were involved. A number of protesters got involved with some of the marchers. More than just words were exchanged. And, you know, basically a disgraceful time was had by all. And, you know, it's interesting to note the psychology of unionism in this particular instance. What were they thinking? You know, I just don't know. And as far as advancing the peace process, I don't see that this did anything to do that. If anything, I would think that the people in the Republic of Ireland, in the 26 counties, would now have just maybe a little more sympathy for what Republicans have to go through every day of their lives, having had it brought front and center to Dublin at the weekend.
Well, Sinn Féin did warn about this happening before the parade occurred, so
maybe
they should have been heeded.
It would have been nice, and of course unionists are completely unapologetic about the entire affair. A couple other things going on right now in the wee north. We've talked a number of times about the Pat Finucan case that is ongoing. And we're talking, of course, about the lawyer who was murdered at his kitchen table in front of his wife and kids 17 years ago by a death squad of paid British agents. Now, ever since, we've been trying to get an inquiry, and we finally got Canadian Judge Peter Corey to do an inquiry, which was sealed. It was published in edited form in 2004, and it recommended an independent public inquiry to investigate evidence of state collusion in the murder of this lawyer in Belfast. Now, after this report came out, the British government put forth new legislation entitled the Inquiries Act, which gives a minister, rather than an independent tribunal, control over any inquiry. And Judge Corey told reporters in Belfast last night that he would be inclined to agree with the Finucan family's objections to this new Inquiries Act. And this is a quote from this Canadian judge. "My goodness, when you look at it, in the middle of everything, you move the goalposts and you change the rules of the game. I just don't think that is the way to run a railroad. But I'm not running the railroad, and it's the prime responsibility of any government to protect their citizens. I recommend a public inquiry, but I cannot tell you, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to tell you, if the government is acting appropriately or not, because I don't know what their basis is. I was asked to do it. I did it to the best of my ability. I made the recommendations, and I stand behind those recommendations. If you told me at the beginning, no matter what you do, we're going to change the rules, then any self-respecting person would say, thank you, no, I just assume not. This is Mickey Mouse. It's Alice in Wonderland. But you don't know that at the time. So it sounds like Judge Corey is a little bit distressed that they have, in his own words, moved the goalposts. And I think it is now clear to anyone who's followed the case of Pat Finucan that he was A, murdered by a British death squad, B, who was in collusion with the British government, and C, the British government has been actively covering this up ever since. Now, you may not be too concerned about what happens to one particular lawyer in Belfast. You know, you've never been in Belfast. Why would it matter to you? But I see in this a pattern which I see spreading further and further afield. And, you know, all this talk about national security and how we're not allowed to have freedom of information about what the government does, when it does it, and why, because of national security concerns. I find this kind of sweeping usage of national security to be deeply alarming, both here and in Britain.
It's like a pandemic, you know, it's a pandemic of secrecy. I mean, when they're hiding, you know, when there's a cover-up like that, I think you're really entitled to believe the worst. It's just, you know, it's, so it's, you know, it's just,
It makes you wonder what they have to hide.
Yeah,
and certainly,
what's coming next? You know, where are they going with this creeping secrecy?
Well, what's coming next is more of the same, obviously. Mm-hmm. The more they're able to get away with it, the more they will continue to do things like that. And since the murder of Pat Finucan, there have been any number of other incidents in which Republican sympathizers or people who might have been perceived to be Republican sympathizers were murdered under mysterious circumstances, and these situations have not been resolved yet. Now, if these situations aren't resolved, how can we have any feeling of security about what our government does? You know, I'm talking, of course, about the Brits in this case, but certainly the same thing's going on over here. One doesn't have to look too far to see it happening over here. Yesterday on Democracy Now, they had an interview with the Canadian fella, who an American judge, citing national security, just said was not allowed to pursue charges against the American government, who shipped him to Syria when he got off a plane from Canada in the United States. And he was tortured for over a year in Syria.
And here we have George Bush talking about Syria being a repressive country at the same time that it ships people there to be tortured.
And then these people have no recourse, no legal recourse whatsoever. Why? Because of national security. Mm-hmm. Well, who are they protecting, folks? They're sure as hell not protecting folks that get off planes in New York, that's for sure.
I don't think he ever got off the plane. He was on the plane. He was refueling or something like that.
Oh, man. Yeah, very, very scary stuff indeed. And, you know, it's an indication of how things are moving. And I think people really need to speak up about situations like this. You know, the Corey report is just one example of this national security state. And, they just simply can't be allowed to use this over and over again and say, well, don't worry your pretty little heads about it. Trust us, we're the government, and we're here to take care of you. You know, I think Irish history is a real good example of why we shouldn't believe that kind of rhetoric. And it's not so far back in the past. You know, 17 years now, we've been trying to determine who murdered Pat Finucane in front of his wife and kids at the dinner table of his house. And really, who amongst us is safe when governments of the world are free to go around doing stuff like this? Well, I guess that's about it.
I think we have a change there in that concert.
That is Monday the 6th. Hi. Thanks very much.
Yes, you just got this little note.
Yeah, I guess Branya Griffin wasn't able to make it over here, but we did get a note from someone, possibly her, and we want to let you know that we have a change in date for one of the concerts we've been announcing. The Karen Casey Band, in a double bill with Fluke, will not be appearing on the 5th of March. They will be appearing on Monday the 6th. Again, that show on Sunday the 5th has been cancelled. Karen Casey at the Mission Theatre on the 5th of March has been cancelled and rescheduled for the following evening, Monday the 6th of March at the Mission Street Theatre. So thank you to whoever let us know about that one. And I guess we're going to wrap it up here. Wanted to have time to... Oh, boy, there were so many other things I wanted to get to, but we'll save them for next week. You know, coming up next week, I'm going to want to start talking about the 25th anniversary of the hunger strikes. Can't believe it's that far on. And, you know, a lot's been accomplished and so much more yet to go in occupied Northern Ireland. We're still under direct British military rule. We're still ruled directly from Britain. The desire of the Irish people for self-determination has still not been respected by British colonists. That's all I can say at this point. And we're still involved in a struggle. Thankfully, the Irish Republican Army has seen that the time has come to move beyond the armed struggle. This summer, they took the historic step, the unprecedented step, of putting all of their weapons beyond use, certifiably, by independent monitors. And this bespeaks a new day in Irish politics, something that's very exciting. Something that we're going to keep a good eye on. Because of the interest of Irish people here in the United States, but also because what happens in Ireland is sort of a microcosm to what's happening in the rest of the world. And it serves as a teachable moment for people to understand the story of struggle for self-determination against colonialism and occupation. And these are things that are so important to us right now. So I'm looking forward to the month of March, talking to you about the history of the Irish hunger strikes and putting them into context, which comes right up to the present day. You know, there are political prisoners right now on hunger strike in Guantanamo Bay, which has been run by the United States government. It's a deep, deep disgrace and morally reprehensible. And it's something we're going to talk about in some detail in the upcoming weeks. And, you know, usually March is the start of the silly season for the Irish. And I'm not going to succumb to that lowest common denominator kind of thing. We're going to talk about the things in Irish history that make it important to all people who struggle for self-determination to this very day. And I hope you'll join us in those upcoming shows when we talk about the Irish hunger strikes and the ongoing struggle for justice around the world. I'm Maura Cullen. Thank you, Per Fogarty.
You bet.
And we're going to leave you with a tune from Hot Ash, a great little outfit from Republican West Belfast. And this is a tune that was written back in 1981, I believe. And kind of speaks for itself. It's called 1066 and the People's Own MP. This is the story of Bobby Sands. I'll see you all next week. Keep it tuned here to KBOO.
Down and to the ground, and righteous men there spoke, and in our need they fixed us good, for free men must be broke. What could be done but smear that scum, and Christ, that is no joke. They do not call you by your name, nor nickname try to fix, for love and hate are hard to mate, and right and wrong don't mix. You have no name but number plain, move on 1066. They call us cons to right their wrongs. They do it with a pen. They call us crims to suit their whims of politics, my friend. But they can call us all they want, for the people call us men.
How many more must I now? How many must we lose? People, their own destiny come to. From a mortal Robert Emmett to Bobby Sands MP, who is given 30,000 votes while in captivity. No more. Upon the altar, or gaze upon the snowflake pure, the calmness deep despair. Before he went on hunger strike, young Bobby did come home. The rhythm of thine, the weeping winds, and MacSweeney died for his freedom to all men. Every one of all our dead died for courageously. And young Bobby Sands went to rule the people's own MP. Forever we'll remember him. Mom, who died? and our delight of music and song.